This was recorded at the 6th 2MAG Live event, The Dark Side of Social Media, on June the 19th, 2007 in London. Featuring on the panel, James Cherkov of Collaborate Marketing, Cristiano Ventura of Microsoft's Windows Live Spaces, identitologist and entrepreneur Luke Rizel, Tim Ireland of Bloggerheads, and Mike Barrett from Compound Media, with Sam Michel of Chinwag chairing. The event was produced by Mike Butcher of tbytes.com, with podcast services provided by Perfect Path Consulting.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming along. I'm standing in for Mike Butcher, who, tonight I will be playing the part of Mike Butcher, just slightly wider and much, much more hair. The idea of these sessions is to involve you. If you've got questions, we would really, really like you to ask them and challenge the panel on all aspects of, in this case, the dark side of social media. So we're not going to do any long presentations, and we'll get right into it. I thought, as a starting point, I would dig out the obligatory stats that you have to front these things up with, so we know the scale of what we're talking about. So my April 2007 statistics from Nielsen tell us that MySpace has 6.8 million users, Bebo has 3.6 million, and Facebook has 2.7 million. That's a lot of people using a lot of social networks. The session times are long as well. We're talking 15 to 30 minutes of people actually browsing these sessions and spending all their time at work updating their Facebook profile with all sorts of... You know who you are. And if all the world's a stage, then you could consider that the social network part of the internet is a village. Or even smaller, it's a bit like Cheers, where everybody knows your name and your age and your gender, your friends, probably your email address and maybe your mobile phone number. They know what you look like. They know what your friends look like. They probably know when you were out drinking, depending on what pictures you've put up on your profile on MySpace. But this has been around for a while. I don't know if anybody knows the name Claire Swires. Does that ring any bells? There's a few nods around the room. I suspect there's quite a few people here who weren't maybe working in the industry when that particular dark moment in social networking did the rounds.
Claire?
I won't go into the exact details, but if you're not aware of her, this was going back to the days before the traditional social networks where email was the main propagation tool. And Claire was the unfortunate recipient, the wrong word, really, really the wrong word if you know the story, is the unfortunate victim, that's the one I was looking for, of an email that was sent by her boyfriend who was complimenting on her, let's say, performance. And he sent it round, and it went round to all his friends, and then it went round to everybody. And within 3 days, she was on the front page. I think it was The Sun, and it might have been The Times, and they ran a campaign to find her. I think he lost his job, and she kept hers. You'll be pleased to hear that she's now happily married, because weirdly, a friend of a friend knows her, but that's neither here nor there. Maybe that's why she's... Anyway... On a more serious and darker note, I was on the phone today with the mother of my goddaughters, and she was telling me how she's having problems at school. She's called Kate, and apparently her classmates have created a MySpace profile called Kate is a Cow, and they've transfixed, put her picture on pictures of cows, and basically, I suppose it's cyberbullying, and... To make matters worse, the school can't do anything about it, or they're saying they can't do anything about it, because the filters prevent them from getting onto MySpace from their network. So she has to go home, get onto MySpace, and complain before she can get the profile taken down. She's 11 years old. Quite grim. And just another little story I'll share, and the names will be changed on this one to protect the innocent. So a friend of mine who was recruiting... for a reasonably senior post, had a bunch of CVs through, liked the look of one of the CVs and decided to progress with the interview. And about 10 minutes before the person was due to arrive, decided that maybe they'd check him out on Google. Didn't really find anything. Went onto Facebook, found their profile. And the last status message that had on their profile was along the lines of, I might be naive, but I didn't realize, rude word, was a particular position. And that was the last thing that they saw before this person opened the door and said, hi, I'm here for my interview. I think that's one of the dangers that I'd like to get into tonight is the fact that your life is now being cached on the internet in a way that it hasn't really been to this date. And the search engines are making it much easier to find that life that's been cached out there. So my quick list of some of the ills of social media, and this I don't think this should all be negative, but I think we should look into the potential for things going wrong and ways that can be avoided or ameliorated in some way. So some of the ills of a brain dump around the office were obviously the paedophile cases that have come to light because of MySpace, which I guess you could argue is a good thing because they've been taken out of circulation. Online groups being hijacked, death threats being made to Kathy Sierra, political bloggers being baited into expressing views that are much more extreme than they'd give in other forums like on TV or on the radio, identity theft, cyberbullying, brands throwing their weight around cyberspace and hoovering up people's information, public spats in blog comments, the transparency of brands online as well, pretending to be or using people's identities to convey the brand message without revealing the full extent of their involvement, spamming, and the final one, which I only discovered yesterday, not personally, I was told about it, is the sex trade that happens in Second Life. Was anybody aware that there was a sex trade in Second Life? Disturbing. There's quite a few definite nods. That's slightly scary. So what I'm going to do is ask the panel to give a 2-minute intro of who they are and also to share a dark experience of the social media that they've had. At the end of that, we'll have a chat and start thinking of questions that you'd like to ask the panel. We have two roving microphones, which currently are at the back of the room. But the lovely Deirdre and the lovely Patrick will be running around with those. If you'd like to ask a question, wave your hand. I'll point them in your direction and ask away. So we have a tip-top panel with some of the finest brains on the planet. And I'll start on my far left with Luke Razel from the Identity Society.
Hi. Yeah, I blog at Weaver Luke about identity and... Generally, that's a concept that focuses various interests I have in technology and business. And I think I came here thinking about... it's a really difficult subject to know how to get a hold of because... On one hand, you have the media shouting out about these various sort of disasters that happen to people in their personal lives. On the other hand, you have the big picture of the social web providing this huge amount of value. I guess my interest is understanding how, although our focus tends to get pulled into the things that really trigger our emotional buttons, like invasions into our privacy, actually the bigger issues are how the web isn't yet really transparent to who we are, and that's the deeper darkness on the social web, if you like. So although we get drawn into things that happen to us that are hurtful, I'm sorry. Do you want to start with someone else? I'm a bit tongue-tied. Sorry.
I think we'll hear a lot more from Luke on the identity side of things, as it's such a critical part of the whole area. One thing I forgot to say is, I can't remember if Deirdre said this, please turn your mobile phones off. Thanks very much. Over to Cristiano, who is head of Windows Live Spaces.
Hello, my name is Cristiano Ventura. I'm the business manager for Windows Live Spaces. I do work for Microsoft. This is where the audience goes quiet. Thank you. Actually, let's put it this way. I'm Italian, sounds better, and I'm Sicilian. My remit is to make sure that our social networking platform just meet the expectations from my safety and security point of view. We do have a percentage of our audience which is made of children and teenagers, so our responsibility is to ensure that they leave the social networking experience in a safe environment. I guess my... nasty story related to social networking. It's actually about Second Life. You just enlightened me. I remember that I was working in Second Life with this brand new leopard pants that I built myself, and I thought I was very proud. And then someone approached me and I said, "Can you take them off?" And I thought, because they liked them, obviously with this whole sex trade, that the intent was something else. So.
Thank you. The one thing I'd say is a big thank you to Cristiano for turning up. We did ask the other social networks to come along, and none of them decided that they would join us. In fact, one of them said that they wouldn't come along because they thought it would be a bit of a bear pit for them. So a big thank you for Cristiano.
Now you can boo.
You can boo now if you'd like. Our next panellist is James Chirkoff.
My name is James Chirkoff. I blog at Modern Marketing, a blog called Modern Marketing, and I work as a consultant helping companies operate in networked media, is how I describe it, which basically is primarily for brands trying to deal with the millions of issues that are coming their way as a result of all these new technologies. I must say, my general feeling, very happy for it to be challenged this evening, is that the internet isn't really very dark compared to the real world. Because it is the real world. I think the separation between the two is the problem. You know, is when we, especially powered by the media, that, you know, the internet is like another planet, populated exclusively by, you know, paedophiles, sex traders, money, you know, launderers, etc., etc. As for my own dark moment, I had I wouldn't really call it dark, it was very peculiar though. I had on my blog, I was having a discussion, and it was the type of very silly branding conversation that you'd only ever have on a blog. And it was about the French Connection FC UK brand. And a commenter on my blog was saying that he thought that it was a dangerous brand because if it could be taken over by the National Front, and they could write T-shirts saying FC UK Jews. So this was his comment, and I didn't really pay an awful lot of attention. However, the Jewish population of New York and their online forum took a very lively interest in this blog, started writing up about me being anti-Semitic and running this modern marketing blog purely as a guise, which, considering my family's Jewish, that seemed to have no truck with them at all. It went on for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks until I finally convinced them that, you know, this was a ludicrous conversation about branding. But it does go to show the new world we live in, I suppose. And if we get the chance, I mean, I thought the whole Cathy Sierra business was a great tale of our times. So if we get the chance to talk about that, then that would be great as well.
I think I'll ask you that in a minute, actually, because I think yep. There may be... How many people in the room have heard of the Cathy Sierra incident? Oh, very few. Well, we'll go into that and why it's significant. But first, one of the people who built some of these systems, Mike Barrett from Compound Media.
Thanks. So I spent 10 years in the publishing world. Building the systems, as Sam said, that hopefully will counter some of the dark side. And I think what's really interesting is, as James said, the kind of parallels between the real world and the online world, and that there seems to be, specifically in the media as well, this kind of disconnect between the people who populate the real world and the people who populate the online world. And actually, they're by and large the same people. And so I think that's really interesting about this subject. I haven't really had any specific dark moments personally, but I think I had a colleague who spoke at an event, an AOP event, the Association of Publishers, who was slightly misrepresented, very, very small misrepresentation, completely innocently, by The Guardian. And the gist of the story was that for this one UK site, and seen as a large organisation, but for this one small UK site, the editorial team were instructed that, because of the nature of the site, that they should interact with the community, very Web 2.0. But this was kind of amplified, and by the time it got to the US and 2 days later, this tiny, you know, kind of 5 million impression a month site was amplified to the point where the blogosphere were then saying all CNET are idiots. You know, so a 5 million impression site actually amplified up to the volumes of, so CNET's like 3 billion impressions a day or something. That's 3 billion impressions a month. So it was all completely innocent, but just the kind of amplification process through misrepresentation was quite interesting. And you know, seeing it's a mature online company, and that was kind of dealt with, and it wasn't a big problem. But you can kind of see how that stuff just gets out of control quite easily.
Thanks, Mike. And on the end, we have Tim Ireland from Bloggerheads, who is a blog supremo. Tim?
Touching, thank you. I've been looking at weblogs for about 7 years and running my own weblog for about six. And I got involved in politics when I, long story, started and ended up getting email intended for Tony Blair. I ran a campaign for Tony Blair's email, produced the first weblog by a Labour MP, and everybody shouted at me. Produced a weblog, first weblog by a Tory MP, and a lot of other people shouted at me. Created a weblog for my local then candidate and later MP, and a lot of anonymous people shouted at me. And it's you get sick of it after a while. In terms of horror stories, I've got some stuff that'll really curl your hair. I think I'll give you one of the juicier ones to start off with. There are two candidates for the position of councillor, and one of those candidates produced an anonymous website about his opponent, first of all, innocently airing these rumours that he was a pedophile. Right? It gets better. Once this was noticed and reported and they got away with it, they got bolder. So they went to outright declarations. The victim of the smears was gay, which from their point of view proved that he was a pedophile because, as we all know, all homosexuals are predators. So, oh, God. And they published his face, his name, and his whereabouts, and they were basically begging some nut job, you know, like the type of person that doesn't know the difference between a paediatrician and a pedophile, to do him an injury. This was reported to Conservative head office. It was reported to the local association. It was passed down to the local MP, who patted him on the head and said, good boy, off you go. It was reported to Blogger. They still haven't taken any action, and this is almost 12 months later. That's probably my worst story. There's more, plenty more.
Oh, and we'll come on to those. So we've done some talking, a little bit of audience interaction, if you don't mind. Can I ask how many people have either their own website or a profile on a social networking site like MySpace, Bebo, Facebook?
Can we split that website at your own domain name?
Yeah, that's so if you've got your own website at your own domain name. So I'd say probably half the room's got some web presence and about a quarter have got their own websites. So getting on to the darker side, who thinks that there's a problem now with social networks and how they're operating? Wow. Four hands, five hands maybe in the room. Who thinks there's likely to be a problem in the future? So that's probably getting on for a half. Interesting. So I think there's so many different angles we can start on this. One of the areas that I wanted to put out to the panel now is there are many, many children using these networks, and they're very web savvy, and they're getting onto them and using them earlier and earlier. It's very easy to create a space and put up all their information. Is the barrier to entry too low? Is it too young for kids to get online and put their information up there? I wonder, Christiane, if you'd like to kick off with that.
It's difficult to set up a barrier for kids because they will find a way of setting up their own spaces. They will lie or they'll Bebo, whatever it is. Larger networks like ourselves or MySpace, they have age limitations. So if you are under 13, you won't be able to set up your own page. But then kids lie. I guess the concept is not about preventing people to create a page. It's just probably educating them. I'm strongly convinced that you can put in place the tools for people to act savvily and to do good things, but then at the same time you need to educate them. You need to partner with, I wouldn't say necessarily the authorities, but with parents and teachers, even babysitters. So it's just a combination element. it's a complex issue that can be delegated to. Let's put all the spaces to private. Let's set up a space so that if you are under 18, you can't do anything. That's not the case.
So is that the default setting for your for Windows spaces? Is under 18, it's private?
On spaces, once you set it up, if you are under 18, your permission settings are set to Messenger only. So only your Messenger buddies will be able to see it. You need to proactively change it to make it public. If you are over 18, it's your decision. You go public straight away.
What does anybody else on the panel have a view on that side? Tim?
We had a quick chat about the default on Facebook with absolutely no warning whatsoever. For instance, I'll take you through the whole journey. Someone talks about you in a private or supposedly public conversation on Facebook, but you can't read it without logging into Facebook. So you join, you log up. It asks for the usual details, like a contact email address, your date of birth to set you apart from the other person called Tim Ireland. And the default setting publishes your email address, any phone number you provide as part of the registration setting, and your date of birth. I mean, that's... You know, if anyone wants to do you harm via fraud, that's beautiful, beautiful information.
So does that mean that the privacy laws that we've got are basically null and void if you go onto Facebook?
Well, where is Facebook hosted?
Fair point. So that's in America.
Yeah. Just like Blogger.
Moving on to identity, Luke, I was wondering if you'd share some thoughts on this. We're obviously exposing huge swathes of our... The ability for us to expose huge swathes of identity is easier and easier. Mm. What's your perspective on doing that?
Well, I guess I've got a very personal perspective right now, having frozen when I tried to introduce myself at the beginning. And I think that really took me back personally to what this is all about, which is authenticity. Because I found myself feeling like I couldn't just talk as me from my own identity. And I think it's really what this is all about. The net is becoming more and more transparent to who we are. But as it does, we're having to give up what we think of as privacy. And that's a hugely challenging thing because, as I just found then, to actually be in front of a group of people who are naked as you are, it can be really scary. And I think that's why it's such a confusing issue, because on the one hand, we want the benefits of this transparency and being able to have all these internet services kind of serve us in a personal way. On the other hand, we're still trying to hang on to this notion of privacy. So,
but is that privacy? Are you feeling that because maybe you're a bit older, you've had some life experience? If you were much younger and you had less experience and you've not come across any issues with exposing your identity in the real world or online, does anybody care? I mean, everybody's, there's what did I say, 7 million profiles on MySpace, at least, that's the UK only.
I think that's a really important point to realise that this privacy issue is going to play out in different ways across different demographics. And we don't really know whether the MySpace generation will go into their work life with a completely different set of attitudes or if they'll actually want to take back some of that privacy, so...
Right. Do they need to be mindful of that?
Well, I mean, of course they do, but then, on the other hand, if we get beyond the concept of privacy, we get potentially to the point where you have this reputation network, where I was thinking when, I think you were talking about the bullying of a school child and the one whose face was put on a cow. And I was thinking, if you had a way of tracking the persistent identity of the people who actually did that, their reputation would suffer too. So you start to see the possibility of this sort of self-correcting system.
But the problem with that is typically anonymous bullies will use what are called sock puppets. Does anyone here not know what a sock puppet is? Does anyone here not know what astroturfing is? Okay. A sock puppet is an online identity that's created so somebody can bully or yell or scream at someone without foregoing any of the reputation that they have online. Blogger makes it very easy to do. Most social networking sites do because it's a matter of... actually, Blogger's a special case because there are users who will decide to let anyone leave a comment on the weblog, which basically allows people to pretend to be 12 different people so they can outnumber somebody else all on their own. And Blogger's system still allows someone who's not a user of Blogger or a different user of Blogger to pose as another user. The system allows it. It's unbelievable. All you have to do is post their profile URL as the other URL, as the other identity, and use their name, and that's it. It's unless the owner of the weblog spots it and picks it up and deletes it. As far as anyone was concerned, you've just been impersonated. What astroturfing is it's the creation of a fake grassroots movement. So you have about, say, four or five people typically working for a party, and each of those four or five people will pretend to be a dozen people, and next thing you know, there's a grassroots movement out there to push this or yell and scream at the other.
So maybe the answer is to hook someone's identity into the National DNA database.
That's no? You see, these I've gone head to head with some of these people, and the first thing they do is they scream privacy and they scream free speech is another one. But in reality, they're undermining other people's right to free speech by intimidating them, by fraudulently misrepresenting their arguments, and by just not giving them a fair hearing. And it works in a number of ways that I won't go into detail with just now. But the argument that reputations are going to be damaged doesn't really stand up.
Well, it doesn't in the current on the current web. But there's no reason to think that identity technology couldn't have evolved to the point where we could start to correlate.
I think
data
that would be a dangerous thing to do.
Well, it might be dangerous, but it might be inevitable. I mean,
so taking this back to from a media owner's perspective, we have two people here who have built and run big social networks or sites that have social networking elements to them. How do you take account of identity and reputation and build that into the tools and the systems that you're putting there? Mike?
So I think, you know, that I still kind of find this bizarre online-offline thing just really weird. So I kind of agree with, from an identity point of view, that maybe the youth of today is giving away too much information or more information. We consider it too much information because we've never given away that information from a privacy perspective. But how quickly do you think that will be corrected when something happens that somebody gave away their telephone number and the media blows that up to be an enormous issue? How quickly do you think that would generate through the Facebook and MySpace generation of 12, 13, 14-year-olds, and they would all remove their telephone numbers? So there's an element of self-correcting from a community perspective that I think will just happen anyway. But just remember, this is really, really early days in this kind of whole social, the movement of social interaction online compared with, you know, what I grew up with, which was we used to all go and play football over the field, which is a completely different thing. So I think there's a self-correcting element from a community. Communities police themselves to an extent. I think the other element of that is communities. So I think the platform, so the MySpace, the Facebooks, and the live platforms are slightly different in that there's not really necessarily any kind of centre of gravity for people to go there, other than the fact that that they want to interact and they want to be connected to their friends. I think from a publisher's perspective, the publishers have content and they have a reason for generating a community around it. And I think the publishers have to take responsibility and the platform providers have to take responsibility for an element of control policing and giving the community the tools to police themselves, but also ultimately policing themselves, policing the environment. So if there's a huge fight in here every night, two things will happen. Firstly, the bar will create an environment where it's difficult for you to have a fight. They'll employ bouncers. And secondly, over time, you won't come to this bar anymore. You'll go to another bar where there aren't fights every night. And the same thing will happen online, ultimately. It's just that it's really, really early days, and people haven't realized where the fights are going to break out. And the fights are going to break out where it's unregulated and that the publishers don't take responsibility.
So in terms of self-policing...
I have a quick interjection there, if you don't mind. The problem is, this it is early days, and it's growing according to people's expectations. And one thing I've noticed, especially over the last 6 to 8 months, is that people approaching political blogging consider it to be one thing that it really hasn't been until very recently. It's like a big shouting match. It's all about gossip and tabloid treatment. And previously, it wasn't that at all. So, I mean, this is a community that's shaped by perception. People are recruited to it by reading it and experiencing it. So it can actually grow in the wrong direction. It could become a self-destructive ecosystem, as it were.
So self-policing isn't necessarily enough. I mean, I think we cited Kathy Sierra in the blurb that we put on the website about this whole topic. And for those of you who aren't familiar, I think that's it could be an interesting insight. I think James had some background on that, for those who aren't aware.
So how many people said they knew who Kathy Sierra was? Right.
Okay. It's about 10.
Right. She is basically a very, very well-known blogger and who blogs mainly about technology and education. And she's probably one of the top 100 technorati blurbers, you know, et cetera, all that business. So very, very well known, very, very heavily linked to, and very, very good at what she does. And a few months ago, she effectively caused sort of a real sort of storm on this particular part of the blogosphere. The easiest way for me to explain what happened is that she put up a post about a certain experience on Tuesday, and this was in California, remember, and I watched Jeremy Paxman interview Tessa Jowell about it on the Thursday. So I'll really quickly try and tell you what I think happened, because I think it's such a brilliant saga of our times. Kathy Sierra effectively got a nasty stalker. And one of the issues that we're now talking about is that anyone can become famous. So the type of person that David Beckham would probably have teams of people just to deal with was a really very scary thing for her, and she blogged about that experience. Because she's a well-known blogger, she has other well-known blogger friends, including Jimmy Wales, who runs Wikipedia, and Tim O'Reilly, who's kind of Mr. Open Source. And they kind of took up her cause. And what they did was suggested a blogger's code of conduct. Now, to me, the only lesson from that blogger's code of conduct was not to ask technologists about social issues, because they'll codify it. And it made almost no sense at all. The only thing I really thought when I saw it was, because these are two extremely intelligent, able individuals, and I just thought, you have to get out more, guys. Because I think they must have been living in this particular part of the blogosphere and not noticed that MySpace and YouTube had arrived, for which this conduct idea was useless. So, all sort of furore happened. But then, obviously, the other aspects of these social networks and blogs, et cetera, is they're international. So, as far as I can make out, this story about a woman being stalked in a nasty way by California, but a one-on-one instance, one person, obviously it happens all around the world the whole time, who has a higher profile, she's a sort of mini fame, if you like, it kind of got wrapped up with all the other prejudices that exist about the internet. You know, it's where all the paedophiles live, and women can't go there because they'll be, attacked. And if you put out any personal information about yourself, you wake up tomorrow morning without any money.
I'm taking my profile down.
What was really scary, and I think this was the interesting bit, the English government, and Tessa Jowell in particular, saw this as a good PR opportunity. And she jumped on it.
I saw that.
Presumably because it ticks every button possible for, an aspiring politician. It allowed her to take the moral high ground. It was about women's rights. It allowed her to look like she knew something about the internet. It was all about anti-child abuse. And she went on to Newsnight and was asked... And Jeremy Paxman started the article with, "We're now going to talk to a minister who wants to ban bloggers."
Brilliant.
So I would just say, basically, it went from one blog post to Jeremy Paxman interviewing an English minister in about 3 or 4 days. The interesting thing is that all these trends are going to continue. Yes, it's early days, but also I think that they're things that we've always had, because it just now seems that when my generation, it was video nasties were going to literally melt the minds of every child in the UK, even though we all got hold of them and we all had them, we'd all seen them and talked about them in the playground. That's what social networks are today. But it was a great, if you are interested in the subject, just look on Wikipedia. It's a wonderful sort of story of our time.
So in the next manifestos, we're going to see a policy point of tough on cyber stalking, tough on the causes of cyber stalking. Brilliant.
I actually said something about this in January before the recent unpleasantness in the UK political blogosphere, saying that if it does get out of control and we don't regulate ourselves, people who know sweet bugger all about it are going to start legislating on us. You know, isn't that
the case about pretty much anything?
Pretty much anything, but you know, we've got it tough enough already. As you mentioned, somebody mentioned media prejudice before. If they can badmouth the interwebs, then they will. Because everyone loves paper. You've got to get your information from paper, not from electronics.
There was something else that came out in the Cathy Sierra debate, and I can't remember the names, but I read on I think it was the Doc Searlesware blog, that some of the people who had been accused of leaving these comments were protesting their innocence and saying that actually their accounts had been hacked and the comments weren't from them. And then because they had been seen to have left these comments, hackers had got into their email accounts and taken over their entire online presence. So it's a very, very slippery picture. Because we don't yet have this reliable way of connecting physical identity to online identity, you can get something getting blown into the media, and it seems to be a very simple, clear-cut case of a stalker of this innocent victim. Whereas, in fact, the real picture can be much more complex.
You also have a problem with people who cry wolf. Sorry, Sam. So, for instance, the woman who was, I can say it now because the police said it and the court said it, the woman who was stalking Rachel North, for instance, you read her weblog and she would thank people for all the emails that you sent in. And on every post, it's like zero comments. So all these people are emailing her instead of commenting. It's because they're afraid, you see, because this person that she's victimizing is victimizing me. And I've had this a number of times. I've had... when I was scrutinising an MP through a website, they were calling me a cyber stalker and using 16 different personalities, all these activists who work for the party that the MP belonged to, claiming that I used multiple personalities to, you know, I was everyone who spoke in favour of myself on my website. You know, it just confuses the issue. On top of that, you've got very popular political websites now where every comment that's negative about the author is shouted down as a brownite sock puppet, or you're a New Labour sock puppet. So the people who are actually sock puppets are yelling sock puppets at the people who are afraid to post under their name because they think they're going to yell at by sock puppets. It gets infuriating. It gets confusing. And at that stage, there's no useful conversation going on. It's just noise.
So this is probably a good time to start bubbling away with questions. Does anybody have any questions they would like to put to the panel? Hands up, please. We've got one... Two, over by the bar. Obviously, the bar is the place to ask questions from.
Can you tell us? Talk too loud.
That's cool. Can you tell us who you are, please?
My name is Roger Conrad. I'm a social media consultant. Anyway, my curiosity is everybody's starting to go with registrations on their comments, which is all fine after the Cathy Sierra incident. I'm wondering if anybody's experienced a significant drop in their comments due to that, because personally, I don't really like registering to every single site that I would like to comment on.
Mike, Cristiano, Mike?
So I think one of the experiences with building these systems is, yes, absolutely. Like, you can get no comments at all if you put registration in front of something that previously would get an average of 5 to 10 comments per post. I think the flip side to that is, from a publisher's perspective, is how genuine, and so where do you set the bar to filter out all of the noise? And so that's different with different audiences, it's different with different topics even. But from a publisher's perspective, that's absolutely key. If you get the bar in the right place, you filter out all of the rubbish, and you only get people that are genuinely passionate about the subject, or that are genuinely passionate about spamming or being abusive about the subject. Right? You filter out all of the people who won't register. And you know, clearly you get registrations from people with false email addresses and stuff like that. And you can spot those. And I think what's really interesting about this is how it's building the systems that enable that to be managed. So the ultimate example of that is GameSpot in the US, where the audience are gamers, right? So their objective is to beat the system. It's all about getting a great reputation on GameSpot. So their systems in the background are pretty sophisticated, and they're tunable so that they can tune out the people who are beating it. But ultimately, your post will get on the site if you've got a great reputation, and your reputation is based on what other people say about your posts. It's based on the amount of traffic that goes to your contributions. And so the cream will rise to the surface, and if you just sign up and you post something and the system doesn't know who you are, the chances of that getting on the site are pretty slim, to be perfectly honest, because they're getting 40 million impressions a day.
So there's an investment in time.
Massive investment. But the investment in time in creating the systems means that you don't have to moderate it, and it's a self-policing society. Now, clearly, that audience are trying to beat the system. So they've had to build something pretty robust, and that wouldn't be the same for, I don't know, Mothercare. So it's different audiences are going to require different levels. But absolutely, setting the bar is really, really important.
Cristiano, what's the Microsoft experience?
Well, I guess our solutions is less sophisticated. And to answer your question, no, we haven't seen a drop in commenting. I guess the reason why we did not have the need of having a sophisticated solution is because the perception of the spaces, or live spaces, it is of a closed network. So the kind of people that you ended up talking to or leaving posts to are your friends. So it's the kind of self-policing. However, what we have seen that in some instances where there were live spaces which were public and they have topics which were quite interesting for a wider audience, then suddenly the self-policing kicked in and people start reacting to nasty comments left by anonymous bloggers, that kind of things. So it's probably the community itself which is regulating.
And I think that's part of it as well. So part of those tools are the community tools. So they operate. So I'm not sure exactly the algorithm that goes behind it, but it's basically a three strikes and you're out. So if the community complains about you enough, then your reputation starts to suffer. And for those guys, it's all about reputation in the community, as it is offline.
What if you're attacked by a bunch of sock puppets who start attacking your reputation?
Yeah, and I mean, Dig's a great example of that, isn't it? That we were talking about before the event. For me, Dig is not a particularly positive example of community, and I think maybe it's interesting to look at the concept of community and to realise that it's neutral in itself. Communities can be very positive and creative, or they can be quite destructive. And I think the Dig mentality can get very aggressive because the system incentivizes quite aggressive behavior.
Is everybody aware of what Dig is? It's most people. Dig is a very simple tool for giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down to a web page or a URL, essentially. It tends to be dominated, and feel free to disagree, by American men sort of between 18 and 34 who... it's the wisdom of their particular crowd.
And so even if it's not deliberate, they have their own little cliques that develop. So, you know, 12 guys who just happen to be related all happen to vote for the same link at the same moment, get it past a certain threshold so other people can see it and maybe they start voting for it. You know.
So before we go off into Dig gaming, which we can come back to, there was another question over by the bar. Oh, sorry, over there.
Hey, Bennett. Whoa. I'll hold this further away. Hey, it's Ben from Neoco. Don't you think that all of this discussion is just kind of a little bit aimless? Because really it's just the next thing for a technophobic media to jump onto and create these sensationalist stories about. For example, the MySpace party where, you know, everyone crashed this party and smashed up a house worth £25,000 worth of damage, etc. I can remember being at school and knowing that somebody's going to have a house party, and so 50 of my mates turn up, and then we all go in, and, well, you know, there was damages caused and stuff like that. But, yeah, that's it, I wasn't there. But and as surprising as it may be that I was actually young before MySpace was around. And it's one of those things that even, like, with paedophilia and identity theft and all of that lot, everything like this has always gone on before the internet, before social media, and it's going to carry on, and whatever the next technology, it will happen. And I think that it only seems to be, relevant for the circle of friends. So where you're talking about people doing sock puppets and stuff like that, and it all goes back to, and I think, I can't remember who said it on the panel there, but someone said about it being like a school playground, and I think that's the very best analogy. And it's where this sock puppet, and it only matters when it actually affects the reputation amongst your actual peers. And if they are your peers, and if they do know you, and if they really are your friends on Facebook, then they would know what kind of comment that you would make and you wouldn't make. And so it's less likely to actually impact your reputation overall.
It's not necessarily people impersonating you. It's one person pretending to be 12 people, which really intimidates people. Let me tell you what the internet can do that that hasn't existed before. I'm going to just pretend, Ben, that you've got kids.
And pretend. None I know of, but pretend.
Yes, pretend. And you've got opinions, and you voice an opinion, and you attract the attention of someone who doesn't think they get satisfaction from your reply, and they decide to take it further. They have a look through MySpace to try and find the most likely candidate for your kids. Okay? Now, all they have to do to intimidate you is get close enough to the school and start trouble amongst the students at the school. That is something that is going to possibly impact on your children, if not intimidate you as an act. I mean, before the internet, those two things couldn't be plugged together.
Potentially, but what I think is that, you know, kids will be kids in terms of if someone's going to get bullied at school, they're going to get bullied at school.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about here is an adult pretending to be a kid and hoping that they'll slip under the radar because there are people saying, oh, kids will be kids.
Cristiano, you had something to add?
Yeah, I think we're just probably talking about the same thing, that the internet is like real life. Actually, it mirrors, but what it does more is just magnify what's happening in real life. I don't think that we should have a different approach. I think that what we should do, we just start applying the skill set, the parental skill set that we have. I mean, we know what privacy is all about. We have a vague experience. I do agree with you. Parties happened 10 years ago before MySpaces and houses were trashed. Now they get the press because rather than 20 people, they turn up being 100 people. It's not about reinventing the wheel. It's just about clear what the media hype is all about. I mean, some of the stats that I was pretty pleased to read about children and teenagers abducted online. First of all, we only talk about teenagers, and it's a small percentage. I was telling the panel earlier on, just 5 or 7% of teenagers have been violently abducted because of the internet. Not something that we should undermine, but it's not the big hype that the media are selling us. So in a nutshell, we do have the skills, we just need to tell people, we need just to clear the clutter and help the media in understanding, the parents in understanding what this is all about. And then some common sense and behavior.
I wouldn't expect a lot of cooperation from the media.
But just to play devil's advocate to what the internet allows you to do now, the flip side of that is that, and clearly the police need to get smarter at this because, you know, there's been some obvious slip-ups. But actually, it's not that difficult for the police to find out who went to the party, which 20 years ago you wouldn't have been able to do. And so that's a kind of flippant remark. But in the paper today, there's a paedophile ring that's been, four guys have been sent to jail. And that's only as a result of some policemen in Canada, who clearly wouldn't have been working on a UK case. There's 15 UK children involved in this. And so these people are leaving a trail now. So you're right, that wasn't possible with the internet before, but actually it wasn't possible to track these people before. And so they're leaving a trail, and these guys who got put away today, they're the dealers, right? They're not the users of this material, they're the dealers, so they're cutting stuff off at source. So I think that's really interesting that, you know, there's a flip side to all the bad stuff, which is the good stuff, and this was on page 4, right? So it doesn't get on the front pages because it's not about MySpace and it's not about Facebook, but it is about good, effectively forensic policing online. And I think that's something that doesn't get reported.
Well, you know what they say about newspapers, if it bleeds, it leads. So I guess the tools are better both on the good side
and the bad side. This is where the internet community can make the difference. Again, is that clean the clutter and make sure that people understand what we're talking about. I don't know if you are aware, but all the larger social networks, including ourselves and Vodafone and Orange, joined together to try to draft some guidelines of best practice for social networking. This before the government started drafting rules that potentially may not be appropriate. So there is the willingness not to regulate, but at least to come up with best practice and help people in making the most out of their internet experience.
Cool. So more questions from the floor? I saw another hand up. There's another hand over there.
Hi.
Hello.
Andy from Media Week.
And over there. Sorry, I missed you behind all the people. Go ahead.
Yeah, we've all heard examples this evening of terrible cases of security breaches or people abusing other people online, etc. I mean, for me, I was just proposed a question to the panel, which is, there's so many security issues out there that if, say, MySpace or a third party can come up with some system where they can guarantee that your personal information will remain private, they can make a hell of a lot of money out of this. So can MySpace, for example, charge a 5 or 10 or a year or whatever and guarantee that your profile will only be privately viewed, etc.?
Good question. So if someone solves the identity problem, do they win in the social network game? Luke, do you want to come back on that?
Well, of course, even if they give you that guarantee, they can't override the Patriot Act. So the US government can access your information, you know, any time they see fit. So that's one important angle to remember there as well. But I think there clearly is value in services offering privacy. I'm not sure if it's something that sells a service in itself, but I think there's been some research that shows that consumers do see it as a positive sort of additional factor when they sign up for something, if they're told that their information will be held securely. But I think this takes us on to the whole identity management question. Is it going to be something that's done via, say, Facebook, where I don't know how many people are aware of Facebook's new Facebook platform. It's creating a lot of waves on the social web because they're opening up Facebook to third-party developers. So effectively, they're saying people will authenticate to our identity system, and then you can come and, you know, work with them to create extra value. And is that the future, or are we going to find a way of distributing identity so we can all have our own identity servers and keep our own personal information and have services come to us? They're two very different futures.
Microsoft have already tried being the central repository for IDs, I guess, with Passport. Cristiano, have you got a comment on that?
Passport was the first attempt to try to standardize identities on the internet. And as you can imagine, the backlash was massive. A big corporation tried to own your identities. There are other projects that we've seen. On the Live platform, we have the Windows Live ID, but there are other projects like the Open ID, if I'm not mistaken, which is an attempt of creating a cross identity that will work across different platforms and not necessarily owned by a large corporation like ourselves.
Is Open ID, which is a distributed system for managing your ID across different sites, is that something that you would look at using?
Personally, it would make my life easier, and if I had the guarantee that the specific data that I'm interested in protecting are protected, yeah. Cool. And people would get used and familiar with it. In the same way we now use credit cards with no major issue, 10 years ago we would have been a bit skeptical.
Thanks. We had some more hands up over there. In fact, there's a guy at the back with a black top and a red T-shirt by the door. People scrum their way through the bar, so please be patient.
Hello.
Hello. That's
weird. I can hear myself through the microphone. Hi, I'm Guy. I work for Mindcandy. We're a games company. I'm here with some people. I want to just ask you if you think that in some ways the changes which kind of identity is going through as a result of the internet can sometimes have quite positive effects. For instance, see, I have a blog which has my name on it because I'm kind of one of those people who's like, look at me, I'm me, you know, trying to establish kind of an identity online that's authentic. So the question comes up, you know, what do I blog, what do I write about, you know, what's kind of off limits, what's on limits, you know, anyone can read it in the world. And in a way, I think, and the same with my Facebook, because I'm friends with people from my work, and I'm friends with, you know, friends with my girlfriend, or I'm friends with, you know, all these different people who I, you know, went to primary school and barely know now. In a way, you know, I find it kind of keeps you honest. Do you know what I mean? It's like you either have to own something and be like, yeah, this is what I did, and, you know, it's kind of, I'm happy with that, you know. Like, I make really bad music, like really bad music. And, you know, but I'm like, yeah, you know, it's okay. And whereas ordinarily in life you might kind of be like, it's just the thing I do, and you're really shy and you want your privacy. You can be like, well, you know, kind of people are going to find it anyway, so you have to own it. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, stuff that you don't want to write about, you're like, okay, that's separate. So essentially, I guess the question I'm asking is, how do you think, you know, in the long term, social networks and things like that will make us maybe think differently about how we, you know, conduct ourselves and think about ourselves online and offline?
James, do you want to, as a fairly high profile
corporate brandy type person. Do you want to come back on that?
Well, I think it's... if you kind of read the mainstream media with regards to this subject, you imagine that every child, literally every child out there, is going out and sort of just willfully putting naked pictures of themselves up on the internet to attract armies of hideous, you know, Macintosh men.
Can I just interrupt? The first article I found when I was researching this was from the Daily Mail, where they were talking...
Right.
It's my only source for news, clearly. Where they were talking about 13-year-old girls from Tunbridge Wells putting inappropriate pictures of them.
I think somebody should have a serious talk with the man who invented puppies.
But I mean, it's absolutely couldn't be further away from the truth. And the only reason is there's a massive generation gap when it comes to these issues. I mean, the way you've spoken very eloquently there about what it brings to your life, and it's obviously a very positive thing. I think that's the major feeling for most young people. And if anyone is particularly interested in this, they could go and look at Dana Boyd's work in the States, who is basically extremely interesting and a great academic on the subject. But in fact, it's the great example whereby kids and children, young people, are the most sophisticated users of this stuff because they use it all the time.
Technically.
And no, I'd say in absolutely every single way. They're the most sophisticated, and they're extremely careful. So like the research shows that they will have a number of friends around them, and they're extremely careful if anything comes to them, not through that group of people. And they're not. It's just so patronising, the mainstream media's approach to say. So if you're approached by someone you've never met before, so you're immediately going to rush out into a dark forest and meet them at 1 o'clock in the morning. It just couldn't be more patronising and further from the truth.
Can I put a question to you? The kids that are online now, and I will accept the point that they're quite sophisticated, not only technically, but how to deal with other human beings and how they use the internet. But the lower the barrier that the entry gets, the less sophisticated your users are going to be. And I think that applies to adults as much as children.
I think I don't quite follow what you're saying. I think
Just picture a world where instead of taking driving lessons and having to earn money and buy a car, you can just go out and get a disposable car and drive it from day one. Suddenly the road's a very dangerous place to be. And different people will come a cropper in different ways.
But then they will come a cropper, but then they'll find a way to manage that situation because the majority, we're not talking about a bunch of kids, young people with no minds. And I think the main worry seems to be, that classic thing of, a lot of the corporate marketeers that I speak to are worried about this subject because they don't know anything about it. All they know is it's what their kids do for 5 hours upstairs in their bedroom.
Adults as much as kids.
All they're really doing is talking to their friends. And they say, well, I'm not too happy about that. So I say something, so you'd rather they were sitting downstairs watching the television for 6 hours with you, like I did when I was young, rather than out there sort of talking and socialising with their friends. So I think, just a word for the youth.
Okay, we had another question, I think, in the middle over there. Gentleman in the rather fetching or white short sleeve shirt.
You're very kind.
Thanks.
I like your hair very much as well. Hopefully I'm not taking this conversation in a completely different direction, but we've talked very much about the individual today. And as someone who sold his soul to work in advertising many years ago, I'm kind of curious about what you feel the dark side is for brands if they come into this space.
Yeah, Tim, would you like to come in on that?
Brand targeting is a piece of piss. Large high street brands don't protect their brand enough. They know sweet bugger all about search engine optimization. They worry so much about being the top search result for widgets that they forget their own bloody name.
Tim, when you're talking about targeting, you're talking about swiping their brand identity and using it for your own...
Yes, you don't have to hijack a domain name to compete for the top search result for somebody's brand name. And I can give you a clear example. There was a guy who used a law firm, and the case did not turn out well. And he decided that the law firm was in on it, the police were in on it, there was a whole big conspiracy. You search for the name of the law firm, and the top search results, the law firm, the second, third, fourth, fifth, all the way down to, the 16th result, are all different websites created by the same individual with a beef about the company.
Mike, another perspective on that. You've worked on large social networks inside a media company that sold, I'm imagining, buckets load of advertising in those environments.
What's been your perspective in terms of the brand relationship with those networks?
I think there's two interesting things about... So clearly, from a publisher's perspective, what they're interested in is page impressions, because when you get a page impression, you can serve an ad. I think what's interesting about the social networking arena is, firstly, that group of people are very sensitive to the advertising that gets put next to their content, and that works from the brand's perspective too. And I think the second interesting thing about that, and it varies again from site to site, but this would be really prevalent on something like MySpace, is actually from an advertising point of view and a targeting point of view, actually most of the time you don't know what they're talking about. So there is no targeting on MySpace other than the Google AdWords. So they don't serve really, they can't sell on MySpace display advertising, because actually you don't know what the people are talking about most of the time. So Google AdWords works fine because you pick up keywords in the content and you serve AdWords against it, and you know that's the way the money's been made in that particular area. But I think if you're a publisher, it's really, really difficult to monetize, partly because of the sensitivity and partly because who knows how to target that stuff. And I think, you know, technology is starting to catch up with that.
But the danger
from a branding point of view is that you get associated with something that's negative rather than positive, which from an editorial point of view is completely under your control.
Is that your experience as well, Cristiano?
Yeah, advertisers have always been very skeptical about advertising social networks because it's an unregulated kind of places. Mind you, the more you can provide them with information about the audience, the more comfortable they become. So I guess you have two approaches. One, you go with display advertising, and again, you have to be respectful, as you said, of the environment. You can't go there with an intrusive ads that plays sounds and expands, so it covers the content, because that will annoy people. And we've got people complaining about expandable, which are overlaid on the text. But the more challenging aspect of advertising on social networking is to become a player, so set up your own profile and start interacting. And that goes deep into the issue that nowadays marketeers face, which is how honest do you have to be to talk to people? And not every company is ready suited to do it. So you open a channel of conversation. That means someone has to be there, someone has to take the nasty comments, someone has to respond.
Some companies can't do it without significantly changing the way they do business.
I do agree, and that's the cultural challenges that we will perhaps face when social recommendation comes into place, when people start following leads of their social networks to buy products.
We've got another question over here, and one over by the bar as well. So, lady here in the black top.
What's your take on...
Can you tell us where you're from, please?
Oh, sorry, Christina from Designate, an advertising agency. What's your take on negative feedback that's left for these big brands, companies that are out there offering services? Because I've heard recently that TripAdvisor was threatened legal action by hotels because negative feedback was left. And yet, if you leave off the negative feedback, you're letting the consumers down, because they're not getting the real authenticity of finding out what people think and the whole...
So
yeah, brands, you know what I mean?
Brands need to be transparent, is what you... Or do brands need to be transparent, and how transparent? James, do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, so I thought a really interesting... I mean, it's just a different world. That's the reality. It's a totally different world from traditional media, which is, you know, where you could command the message, control the media. Who here came across the Chevy Tahoe campaign that GM ran in the States?
That's about five hands if you're listening to the podcast.
Right. So very, very quickly, what happened? Chevy Tahoe decided to jump on the latest bandwagon of user-generated media and ask their users to come out and create short 30-second spots for the new Chevy massive, great, big... you know, those huge big vans, whatever they call them in the States, SUVs. And basically what happened was about 2 or 3% of them were basically written by the environmentalist lobby, complaining at the amount of, you know, they were just massive gas guzzlers and bad for the environment. And this was kind of picked up, just that small percentage of adverts were picked up on, and they were thrown back at GM's face saying, this has gone wrong, hasn't it? Isn't it awful? You know, you've been made to look completely ridiculous by your consumers. And GM stuck by it and just said, you know, we don't think that the story that SUVs are bad for the environment is news. And, you know, oh, really? Oh, no, well, now you've brought that to our attention. That's, I'm not going to buy one. And they actually felt that it had basically done the job. It raised the profile, and there was even some sort of hint that basically the people who hate tree huggers bought one for that because of those adverts.
Moon
so
bats,
it's just a
yes.
New world when like, you know, all the kind of like new rules happening.
Tim, can you be brief? Because we've got a couple more questions to get through.
Okay, I hate to go back to identity, but I can quote you at least two examples where a company was receiving a lot of negative feedback by email, big time waster emails, and on the website where possible. And I track the activity back to their direct competitor. Okay? And you've got another example where there was a charity that was under criticism on a separate website, and all these comments started coming in from anonymous members of the public saying, oh, you shouldn't, this is a fabulous charity and it's really terrific. And all of those visits were tracked back to the charity.
Mike had a quick comment as well.
I just think from a branding perspective, it comes back to your point about brands not being ready for some of this stuff. And actually, if there's negative comments, then really what they should be doing is listening. Because that's the only way that they're actually going to improve the product. And so again, there's another really famous case with the kryptonite bike locks, which if you Google that, you can open with them a bit biro, right? And it's just a classic case study of not listening and not engaging in the conversation.
So it all comes back to customer service, plain and simple, I guess. We've got another question over by the bar, and then there's another gentleman in a brown top at the back of the room.
I'm Alan Patrick. I co-found a consultancy called Broadsight, and we blog on broad stuff. The thing we've been working on is, I guess the only word I've got for it is dynamic identity, which is you can find somebody's static identity, but you can also see by their transactions, you can start to understand more about them. One of the issues that brings out is the level of intimacy that any one social network allows, or the layers of intimacy. Like if you take Facebook, it's like friend, not friend, maybe with a few things. And one of the things that occurs to us is, if you had far more layers of intimacy or far more nuances in the way a social network worked, you'd actually get over a lot of the gaming issues in these things. I just wondered if anybody else had looked at these issues.
Luke, you've got a comment on that?
I think this takes us into actually a huge topic area that we probably don't have time to cover properly. But
let's keep it short. We're getting thirsty.
Sure, but we must touch on it because if we're talking about integrated identity, then the whole problem of exchanging data across different ways of describing data on the web is a huge and outstanding problem that hasn't been solved. So you have Facebook saying, you know, there's 8 or 16 different ways you can describe a relationship. Well, human beings don't work like that. We don't think like that. We're much more sophisticated and individual ways of thinking. And we have evolved over a very long time the ability to understand each other even when we communicate in different ways. And that's a natural part of our socializing in the physical world. Technology is a long way from doing that. And it's a massive stumbling block for us actually distributing identity and doing
Online identity is basically a pretty rubbish way of identifying yourself on the internet because you lose all the subtlety.
It's early days.
We had another question over at the back there.
Hi. sorry, excuse me. I just wanted to kind of...
Can you say who you are?
My name's Sam, and I basically blog... whenever I feel like it, really. I don't have another job, really, at the moment, but it's going well. I basically just wanted to kind of back up the point that I think it was James made about GM, because I actually worked for GM for a little while, and this Chevy Tahoe kind of experience, it kind of divided the marketing people at GM into two camps. One of them was basically, okay, look, see, I told you, doing this kind of thing is bad, we should never touch it again, and social media generally is just not worth it. Let's just kind of continue getting beat by Toyota. And I think the second camp was something that kind of crystallized in the Vauxhall Corsa launch that just happened in September. And that was the creation of these characters called the Commons, who are basically fictional rock stars who are kind of seeded onto MTV. And not we because I don't work for them anymore, but they seeded these videos out onto YouTube and encouraged people to make their own. And some of the videos that came back were like really pornographic, like basically puppet porn. you know, whatever floats your boat, I guess. But it's something that I think brands need to, number one, educate themselves, because like at GM, there were the digital marketing team at GM consisted of two and then three people, and then one of them left. So this is the number two car maker in the world, and it's their presence in England. And, you know, I hope none of my former co-workers are here, otherwise I'm getting a bad reference. But, you know, it's just one of those things. I think brands need to, A, work at it, and then, B, embrace the, you know, embrace the backlash, as it were.
I think that's an interesting observation, that brands, how seriously large brands are taking what's clearly a massive sea change in the way that the web's being used. Tim, you had something to add?
I think the risk, particularly for smaller businesses, is if you don't communicate online in a positive way, then all people are going to see is when you get it wrong. You know, there's going to be the official corporate version and that time where it just all went to hell.
I think, has anybody else got any more burning issues? Oh, we got one more. I think we'll make this the last question or two. We'll keep them brief over by the bar here. Because is everyone getting thirsty? I'm getting quite thirsty. So,
I was actually going to ask you, what do you want to drink? It's Ian from EMAP. I just want to know, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned about 8 or 9 issues at the start of the proceedings today. In your mind, which is the biggest one? And in the panel's mind, what's the solution, please?
Good question. I'm not sure we're going to be able to cover that really quickly. For me, personally, I think reputation is the big one, and that's, I think, bundled up really, really closely with identity. I don't think anybody's got the faintest idea of how to handle it, and my big bugbear at the moment is your reputation is sprinkled across dozens of different places, from LinkedIn to Facebook to MySpace, to your email, to your blog, to how you're represented on your website, and because it's so dispersed, and you leave this stuff, and you forget about it, and it sits there, and Google's still feeding off it long after you've moved on, you're leaving this trace. And, of course, there's the archive of the lists that we used to run. Chinwag now gets... I'm talking about the Chinwag archive. Tim's mentioning the web archive, where there are obviously, you know, your previous activities are there as well. But we have an archive of emails that have been sent to the UK Net Marketing list, and we probably get 1 or 2 emails a week now from people who are saying, I was really new to the whole industry in 1996. I didn't really know what I was talking about, nor did anybody else. Can you please take that post off? Because I'm now VP of something big at a major corporate. I look slightly silly. Panel, any solutions in 10 words or less?
You said it. Someone has to solve the reputation and identity problem. That's it. And it's too complex to solve in the next 5 minutes, but I'll see what I can do, all right?
I think some people will learn the hard way how to cope with reputation, and others will understand that perhaps you don't want to post all the pictures of that party. Can you hear me? Yeah, what I was saying is that some people will learn the hard way, others will have it easier, and they will learn not to post all the pictures, because at the end of the day, there are still some aspects of your life that you want to protect. And nowadays, everyone knows how to handle emails, kind of, because of what happened with Claire 5 years ago.
So we need some sacrificial lambs. Mike, you had something to add?
I just think that the people who make the mistakes, because of the way the media is globally now, those mistakes will be amplified and everybody will learn about that. And I think if you look at the statistics, there's probably no more or less nutters, paedophiles, lunatics, weirdos, stalkers in the world now than there were 100 years ago. It's just that from a media perspective, those get blown up. And so the lessons that are learned will be learned by a lot more people a lot faster. And the results of that will be learned a lot faster. And I think people will just get a balance. And I think it'll correct itself. It's always going to happen. But, you know, statistically, you know, the number of kids that are abducted by people who don't know them hasn't changed for the last 30 years. Right? It's between 6 and 8 kids a year. And it hasn't been affected by mobile phones, CB radio, internet, TV nasties. It hasn't been affected by any of that stuff. It's been pretty consistent. What's changed has been the media perception of that and the media expansion of that. So I think that will fuel the balancing.
Luke, you had to...
I guess going back to the reputation point, I was thinking maybe the flip side of authenticity is compassion and acceptance. You know, we were talking about sort of sexual shame and things like that, and you know, I felt pretty embarrassed when I froze up at the beginning of this, but... You know,
with friends, don't be embarrassed.
Exactly, and that feels really good. And I think that's maybe a social change, that we're learning to be more accepting of ourselves and each other, and that's a great thing.
Cool. James?
I've found one really handy thing on my blog is just ignore and delete anonymous commentators.
I think that goes for email and all the other spams. We've got, Deirdre, you've got a question?
Yeah, I went to a conference last week that Dan Gilmore spoke at. If anyone doesn't know, he's the author of a book, We the Media, and he's a very well-respected commentator. And he was talking about social media, and he made the point that we need to cut each other some slack. So, like, for instance, with things like, you know, Facebook, MySpace, and the whole problem, or not the problem, but the fact that a lot of your life is being cached and saved, and even if you delete the thing, it'll still be there somewhere. You know, he basically said, are we going to hold each other up to the standard of the stupidest thing we ever did for the rest of our lives? Or are we going to cut each other some slack? And this is what I think is really interesting, because if notions of privacy are changing, there is a lot of people who are going to get burnt, but it is a cultural shift. And a question I have, there isn't time to be answered, is like, who is going to protect the people who are going to be sacked for some silly comment or putting up some photographs of them out drinking or something? So
it's already happening in the blogosphere. But we should probably talk about this in the office. I should point out Deirdre is the editor of chinwag.com, which is why I didn't. We've got one last question over at the back.
Hi, my name is Leanne. I'm from the NSPCC. And obviously we have a really strong interest in social networking, mainly from the fact that we want to, obviously our aim is to protect children online. My question is kind of twofold. One is we've successfully used online or social networks, specifically Bebo, for our campaigns because we actually target our messages to children around, obviously, online safety and stuff in these networks because we know we can't get them to our site. We'd rather get into the spaces that they're in. And that's worked really well for us. Second to that is that obviously we do have a very strong awareness of what is happening online with children. And I think you downplay it when you say, there's not many kids that have been kidnapped and or abducted, etc. I think the situation is quite serious. I think from an identity point of view, kids give away a hell of a lot of information. And we need to, obviously, as an organization and with other charities, work on a way of protecting children online. And basically, we're doing work in that arena now. My question, it kind of boils down to, how do you see children being vetted, or not vetted, but the fact is, you know, if I sign up and I say I'm 13 years old, who checks that? How do we get around that, the fact that anyone can sign up, pretend that they're a certain age, and get into these teenage networks or these children networks?
So we're back to the how do you verify someone's identity in the real world from their online presence, I think.
Yeah, and obviously then with the aim of protecting children.
Luke, do you want to come back on that quickly?
Well, obviously it's a huge topic. And in this country we have the government seeking to develop this ID card, which originally was going to be a fairly draconian scheme that would really know, they would know a lot about us, and we'd have to use this card to for public services and what have you. I don't know how it's going to play out, really. It's a very complex issue.
So no answers, we need to keep looking. And I think with that we'll draw the panel to a close. Everyone's getting warm and no doubt would like to hit the bar. However hard they'd like to hit it, that's fine with us. I would just like to say a very big thank you to our panels, Tim Ireland from Bloggerhead, Mike Barrett from Compound Media, James Cherkov from Collaborate Marketing, Cristiano Ventura from Windows Live Spaces, got the brand right, yay, and Luke Rozelle from the Identity Society. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, CNET Networks UK, our media sponsors, and AdTech London 2007, 26th, 27th of September, down at Olympia. And thank you for Duncan for helping on the door. Well, the last thing I'll say is the big Summer 07 Chinwag party at, sorry, networking event, not a party, obviously, at Imperial College is getting a lot of registrations. We will have to cap it relatively soon. So if you would like to come along, it's on the 5th of July. Please join us. There's free drinks, barbecue, entertainment, casino. Sign up at bigsummer.chinwag.com. Thanks very much.